There's a phrase we're going to explore today. It's God will let you believe what you need to in order for him to get you where he wants you. And so in that, in those moments that it's not believing what your dream is saying, what do you do with that? Because I remember there was a time as I studied history that there was some men who wanted to create an airplane, but they only knew how to make bicycles, and there wasn't like this full plan of here's how we're going to do what we're going to do. There was a dream inside of them, so they merely went and did. There was a time when a president stood up and he said, "We will put a man on the moon." I guarantee you there was more hows than there was ability that we currently knew about. But guess what? When you put the dream out there, it almost demands that you leave familiar and enter into the borderland, enter into the unknown, enter into what you've always had, because what you've always had isn't giving you what you need, because what you need, there's a dream inside of you being birthed. And if it takes nothing more than you standing up and saying the phrase, "I have a dream." Could you imagine doing that on the steps in Washington when racial divide was throughout a nation and you were actually at that time considered on the wrong color scheme side of things, but yet you didn't stand up and say, "I have a PowerPoint that I would want to show you. I have a strategy and a policy I need Washington to pass." You merely stood up and you declared, "I have a dream, and the dream is to see this and for us to think like this and as a nation to be this." And sometimes just having a dream is better than having a plan, because the dream can move you out of the familiar that you know into the unknown that you're called to. And in that unknown that you're called to, you get to succeed what God has put inside of you. How many feel like dreaming today? How many feel like stepping out of the familiar? How many feel like going into the unknown? How many feel like shaking up your normal because your normal is boring, right? And so here's the thing. I think you were created more than just for normal. And so in order to do this, we are actually going to have a few different conversations in today's sermon, and it's all going to revolve around a guy named Joseph. Now, when I say Joseph with the sweet-looking jacket, how many of you know which one I'm talking about? Because if we were in December, you'd be like, "Joseph, oh, Mary, the one, you know, the baby's mom." And okay, so no, this is the other Joseph. Actually, Joseph had a pretty famous grandfather, Father Abraham. How many of you know his theme song? Okay, let's do it together. Father, oh, good, you really do know it. Please stop singing it. We don't sound good. We need the band back up. So Father Abraham had many sons. And when it says many sons, it meant like son. So Isaac. So Abraham had a guy named Isaac. You may know this story just a little bit because, well, there was a time where God asked Abraham to take his son Isaac and put him on an altar and sacrifice him, which, by the way, not one that us Christians start with, like when you're telling people about Jesus, because it's a little hard to explain, except God never wanted man to die like that. He wanted his son to die like that, which we'll talk more about later. But Jesus was supposed to die for humanity, not Isaac. But Isaac had a couple sons, Jacob and Esau. Have you ever heard of them? They had a pretty hairy situation. I wrote that one myself. So if you don't get that, go read it, and you'll just find out one of the brothers is really hairy. So then you had a guy named Jacob. So I'm going to give you more Bible. I mean this. I'm going to give you more Bible in the next 5 minutes than you've had all year. If you're excited about that, say amen. Okay, because I want to tell you that Joseph was so hated by his brothers, they wanted to kill him. But just saying that doesn't make a lot of sense because, I mean, we all have brothers and sisters, and we've not got along, like, I think 3 times in my family. But, like, I can't imagine ever wanting to kill somebody. But when you find out how Joseph came about, you go, okay, I kind of get this. And so I'm going to put up a PowerPoint because I need you to process through the thought that I'm about to give you. Again, you can find all this in the Bible. You had a guy named Jacob. Jacob, it was time for him to get married. So Jacob went looking. When he went looking, he found a woman by the name of Rachel, who also had a sister by the name of Leah. Okay? Now, I put little parentheses to help you know who's. Rachel was the one that Jacob loved, but Leah was the older. And I mean this, you can find this in the Bible, don't judge me. It does say this: Leah had weak eyes. Here's how we translate that now. She must have had a good personality. No, I'm serious. Like, Rachel, she was the looker. Leah, you'll find out she had the childbearing hips. Like there were just two different sisters. Don't judge me. It's in the Bible. You can find it for yourself. But like that's how obvious the Bible's making it. Do I need to make this example any better? Do you have it? Because I really feel like I should stop or you're going to tell my wife on me. Okay, so you had the older and you had the younger. You had the good-looking one and you had the less desirable one. So Jacob went to the dad and said, I'd like to marry Rachel, the one that I love, the younger one. Dad said, good, let's do this. Work for me for 7 years and then I'll give her to you. This is true love at this point. So works for 7 years. That night, Jacob goes home, gets into the bedroom chambers. The next morning, apparently when the lights came on, he found out the other sister, Leah, was in bed with him. So Jacob's like, hey, dude, like I bought that one and you gave me this one. You know, okay, you guys remember the difference between two. So Jacob goes, it's not our custom for the older to get married after the younger. You have to marry her first, but I'll make a deal with you. You go ahead and work for me for 7 more years and I'll give you the younger daughter, you know, the one that you love. Jacob goes, not a problem. So about a week goes by, the marriage ritual's over. He actually marries Rachel then and they start moving towards 7 years of working. During the 7 years of working, they did a lot of work in the bedroom chambers. And here's what I mean by that. Leah then starts having babies. The first baby she has is a guy named Reuben. This is baby number one. She names him Reuben because the Lord has seen my misery. How would you like to label your kid with that one? The Lord has seen my misery. But then Rachel still can't get pregnant. Leah, the older one, the one that he doesn't love, has another baby by the name of Simeon. And it says, I named him that because the Lord, I'm not loved. Loved by who? My husband. So then baby number three comes along, Levi, my husband will finally attach himself to me because I've had 3 boys for him. Like these are what she's naming her kids. Still nothing. Baby number four comes along to Ray. Nope, Leah. Welcome down. She's at number 4, Judah, which finally she names him, praise the Lord. She's turned the corner. She's had a revelation about who Jesus is, which he's not here yet, but like a revelation of who God is, you know, and all things are going to be good. The Lord loves. And then Rachel goes, I need to get a baby to my husband, but I can't have a baby. But what I do have is I have a servant. So Jacob, take my servant and have a baby with my servant. And now in America, we'd go, what? Like, this would be like Desperate Housewives of Israel right now. Like, this would be like hit TV show trending all over the place. This would be huge, huge TV at this point. I will say this. Back in the day, this is kind of what they did. It was never God's plan. God's plan was one man and one woman. And he actually said that again in the New Testament through Jesus. But right now, mankind, these are some of the rules that we're putting together. And God's trying to keep us limited in our destructive behavior. But regardless, Rachel gives her maidservant, Bilhah, to Jacob. And she gets the son, Dan. So Rachel names him Dan because God has finally vindicated me. Okay, no, he gave him a baby with your handmaiden, but okay. But then the handmaiden comes through again, gives him another child, so this is the 6th one, Naphtali. And she named him this because I've had great struggles with my sister and I won. I'm going to just throw this out. There was never a healthy Thanksgiving in this family. Do we see this? So now we're having babies back and forth. We're having this constant struggle. Leah's womb is shut up. I want to have more kids for my husband because I'm desperate for my husband's love. So Rachel gave her handmaiden away. I'm going to give my handmaiden away. So now Jacob is sleeping with Leah's handmaiden to bring about another baby by the name of Gad. Gad, why? Because I have good fortune. So now we go to baby number 8, Asher, still with the handmaiden. And it actually says this, how happy I am. And this is when the story gets good, if it hasn't been to this point. So there was a boy named Reuben. You guys met him earlier. He's way up top there, the oldest. He's out working in the field, and he finds something called madrecks, which, by the way, I promise you can find all this in the Bible. Go read it for yourself. He finds these madrecks, and these things were known as an aphrodisiac at that time. And if you don't know what that is, Google date night oysters. You'll figure it out. So this aphrodisiac, but it was also believed to be a healing agent that would open the womb of a woman. So Rachel comes to Leah, Rachel is the loved one that can't have kids, comes to the other wife who keeps having kids, thinking that will get her love, and she says this, I need those madricks so I can get my womb open so my husband can love me so I can give him a child. And Leah literally says this, how could I possibly help the woman who steals my husband from me? Let's double down here. I really don't think these two women get along. And then it was, I will go ahead and give you this ointment, this plant, if tonight when Jacob comes in from the fields, I get him in my bed. So now you have the two wives bartering of who gets to sleep with the husband. Rachel makes the deal because she thinks there's some magic potions he's going to drink and become a baby factory. And so next thing you know, she gets the mandrakes. Jacob goes home with Leah. Leah, ta-da, has another baby. So this is now baby number 9, Issachar. Why? Because God has rewarded me. And then you're thinking, Rachel, you're going to have a baby soon, right? Nope. Leah has number 10, Zebulah. My husband will finally treat me with honor, is why she names her in that. Can you see what the moms are doing right now? And then Leah has another child, and I hear how, but it was just a girl. So it kind of doesn't matter in this hierarchy, this lineage thing that we're putting together, which, by the way, has anyone ever heard of the 12 tribes of Israel? Okay, we're at number 10. We finally get number 11, a guy named Joseph. And guess who has him? Rachel. The one wife that has been trying to have a baby this whole time that Jacob worked 14 years for, that she just wanted to have a baby, and every time she couldn't have a baby, she starts playing these games of manipulation to try to have the baby. And then finally, when everybody else has done what they've done, the Lord actually says that he opened up her womb. So if I say to you, the mom Leah, who feels like Rachel stole her husband from her bedroom chamber, Leah, the wife who continually had sons nonstop for her man, Leah, the one who never felt loved, what do you think she said to the kids all the time? I have a clue. And when they saw Joseph coming, all those other half-brothers said this, let's kill him. So here's, as I kind of was laying this out, how many are okay with that amount of Bible in that short a period? You got it? Okay, so as I was kind of laying that out, a few things started running through my mind. And one, I'm not sure I'm overqualified or qualified to even talk on. Because I come from what's considered like a minority family in this sense. There's a total of 5 of us kids in one family. I've only ever had one mom, one dad. The entire time that I've been alive and that they've been married, they were never separated, never divorced. I don't have half-brothers or half-sisters from anywhere. I believe there were 2 times mom killed dad, but she believes in prayer, so she raised him back from the dead. And she might have, like, killed him right away and raised him right back. But how many wives have done that for? Okay, so, like, that's the only thing I remember. I was never physically beaten. Cigarettes were never put out on us. Actually, today I told one of my boys, I said, you're my favorite as long as you don't tell the other kids. And my wife said, that's what your parents did to you. All they did was tell you they love you. And I go, well, look at me. I turned out awesome. Like that was what I said to my wife. Yes, that is how I view myself. You're welcome. So, like, I'm so sorry that I had constant reinforcement of hope throughout my life. Like, and then here's why I say my next thought, I'm not sure I'm qualified for, but I've done a whole lot of counseling. And I do know I've seen this. I've seen people that have separated or are separated use their kids as weapons just like these two moms did in their house. And when the son comes home for the weekend, dad begins to condition them to think against her. And then they go home to mom, and mom begins to manipulate the mind and the story and the situation to be used against. And I've been through a lot of counselings with a lot of people and had multiple conversations. And if you choose to use your kids as weapons in a relationship warfare, it will only be murderous to someone. And so, we usually don't throw out something that heavy, that blunt. But man, if I passed up this story with this type of definition, with this type of knowledge in it, and not use the warning that we see, I'd be remiss. And again, I haven't lived that life, so I don't want to speak into it, except that I have walked through with a lot of people who have, and the children shouldn't be a part of it. Actually, I guess the thing I should be thinking of is, what is our job as parents? My job as a parent is to raise them up in the way that they should go, so when they're old, they don't depart from evil. It isn't to use them to manipulate to get my way so that I can get a bigger alimony check every month. And maybe we've never consciously done that. Maybe we never on purpose done that. But what happens is, if we do that, you only end up killing the people that are around you. So I say that with as much peace and as much love and as much grace as I possibly can. And if you feel that that has happened to you, I promise you this, you can be better. Because God's going to put you on a journey. And you don't know why you are where you are, but God's going to let you believe what you need to in order to get you where you are. And currently you believe what you believe, and that's called the land of familiar, but he wants to get you out of the land of the familiar into the borderland. And the only way to do that is to take a journey. Now, Joseph's dream started with betrayal. And I know a little bit about betrayal, especially, and it's in small ways. You know, like this past Friday night, when you come home and you go to bed in your house that you're safe in, that people would no way, shape, or form, you know, vandalize. But then you wake up the next morning and you find that your entire front yard's been filled with pink flamingos at exactly 11, 12 at night. And no one would admit to it. No one wants to talk about it. But you feel like these people, Cam, are you on me? Because I got to move. You feel like these people know where you live. You've had them in, like, to be at your house to eat. And you wake up, and throughout your entire front yard, flamingos, and no one's admitting to it, despite the fact that there's a camera in the neighborhood, and you caught their car on tape turning at 11, 12 at night. Listen, there are some levels of betrayal that we're talking about. And that one's probably completely made up at 11, 12 at night this past Friday, with 14 flamingos. So, hashtag get the flock out. What are they trying to say to you? What are they trying to say to you? But that is one level of betrayal. Joseph is at a whole nother level of betrayal. Why? Because he starts coming and he wants to see his brothers who are currently out with their sheep on the field. They get there. As Joseph is approaching them, here's what I believe has happened. I think Joseph is excited to see his brothers. He's reaching out to hold them, to see them. They reach back and begin to beat him. And it actually says this in Genesis chapter 37, verse 23. It says, so when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, that ornate robe, that fancy robe, that expensive robe that dad bought him. And they took him, threw him into a cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. And as they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw the caravan of Ishmaelites. And they're coming down and about to go to Egypt. And we have a couple conversations that happen here. And the first thing that I noticed in reading this scripture, this is crazy to me. It says that they took their brother, they stripped him of his robe. You know, that fancy robe, that Armani robe, that way too expensive to be out here in society robe. They took and stripped of him. They threw him down in a cistern, period. The very next sentence, they sat down and ate a meal. Have you ever done something in your life that was so horrible that you lost your appetite and lost your ability to sleep at night? Have you ever been in such a stressful situation that you've lost the ability to just be free to live naturally? Okay, these brothers were so far away from that, when they got done, they ordered takeout pizza. Hey, what topping do you want? You want deep crust? Of course you want deep crust. We got to have the Papa John's sauce. Okay, like we know what we're going to order. They are so comfortable with the atrocity that they just put on their brother. They threw him in a pit and they sat down and they started eating. Now you find out two of the brothers, one Judah, one Reuben, did something a little different. Judah said, hey, why are we just going to kill him? That doesn't profit us at all. Let's sell him. If we sell him, at least we make some money off the deal. A lot of theologians believe this was Judah's way of actually protecting his brother. Wouldn't be the best way to protect him, but at least he's still alive. Reuben, it says that he planned on later that night when everyone was asleep to come down, pull Joseph out, and actually free him. As I read it, I define two friends that no one wants. Friend number one's the willing to have a friendship with you as long as they benefit from you. You want me to stay alive? No, what I want is you not to die, because if you die, I don't make any money off of you. Have you ever been in a relationship where you feel like all they do is take, 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 and all you do is give, give, give? I'm just going to throw this out there. Maybe not the healthiest relationship to be involved with. Now, it doesn't mean that the relationship can't change, can't morph, and can't get better, but at the end of the day, what you're going to find out is you're sold into slavery while they're benefiting off of your reputation. But then you have Reuben, who was so interested what all the other brothers had to say, or can I say this, his public reputation, that instead of speaking up on what's best for you, Reuben says this: in public, I'll bear you, but in private, we're best friends. Man, I'm here for you. I'll rescue you. I'll do what I can to get you up out of your pit. No, Reuben, if you were truly my friend, I never would have been in the pit. Judah, if you really cared for me, you wouldn't have been a part of grabbing my robe to see what you could sell. And so I'm just going to say, as we move forward in this, as you move forward in your life, out of the land of familiar, into an unknown, some of your unknown, and we're eventually going to use the phrase, some of your borderland bullies might actually be the friends that you think are on your side, but the reality is they're all about themselves. And I'm not saying just walk away, and I'm not saying don't be their friends, but I think you can be at least aware, because you know it is okay at times in your life to say to someone, I don't have more to give to you. And you know what you do? I promise, this, go to God. Point them to God. He's there to pour out. He's there to give. And if all they do is try to go to the next friend and not to God, it kind of points back to their character anyway. And so now you have Joseph. He's down in this pit. He's been taken away. He's been thrown down. And then in that bottom of this pit now, I started thinking this past week, what was Joseph thinking? How was he feeling? Because I assume that when he first got there and his brothers began to attack him, it threw him for a loop. It freaked him out. Right? Now, they've been mean, and he's been the butt of jokes and all that kind of stuff, but now you are physically harming me. You're pulling away my jacket. You're throwing me into a pit. Do you think he immediately started threatening them? Wait till Dad finds out about this. I'm thinking maybe. You know, if you kind of read about who he was arrogant enough to tell everybody about his dreams. So there could have been a level of arrogance, but then while he's down there, at what point did the stark reality of the situation come collapsing around him and he realized, I'm not getting out of this? So then he desperately goes to save himself and he begins to climb and he begins to push and he begins to crawl, and every time he does, more dirt, because remember, there's no water there. This is as dry as can be, so every time he pulls it, more dust gathers in his face. His fingernails are full of gunk and he begins to cough and he begins to spit, trying to clear the dust out from the situation that he finds himself in. And then does he start pleading? Man, I've cried before, but I don't know if I've ever cried for my life. You know when you're talking so much, water's coming from eyes, nose, and mouth? When you're begging, the only brother that you think still would have empathy or sympathy for you, please, can you help me? Why are you doing this? What did I do to you? You think there was that soul, guttural plead of desperation? And I'm wondering if it came to an end somewhere around the time when he heard him go, why kill him? Let's sell him. Oh, guys, don't sell me. Guys, what are you talking about? I'll stop doing it. Help me, please. And then you hear him eating. And I'm going to guess laughing. And then you hear him start talking about this caravan. Here they come. Let's check them out. Oh, you guys are going to Egypt. Man, we got a sale for you today. Look at this young kid. He's 17 years old. He's never been out in the sun like we have. His back is strong. Check out his teeth. Like all of a sudden, he finds himself on the sale block of humanity, being sold by his family that's supposed to love him. How alone did Joseph feel in that moment? How isolated, how abandoned. And I have, some would call it prediction. Some would call it prophetic. Some would call it just obvious. I would guess there's enough people in this room right now, and those of you watching online, that when I say he was isolated, abandoned, and betrayed, you're sitting here right now going, I know exactly how he feels. I recently heard that there's 7 billion people on the earth and 6.8 of them have some type of mobile device in their hand where they can connect with humanity. Why do we still feel isolated? Why do you feel like when you go to school, there's only bullies there? Or when you go to work, you're the black sheep? Why is it when you're at family events, you don't seem to communicate like everybody else? How is it that you're sitting at Navigation Church right now, shoulder to shoulder with people you know and you don't know, and despite the fact that I'm saying you belong here, you go, but I still feel by myself. Isolation is a tool to keep you unfamiliar. And I want to say this to you today, take courage. Take courage to move out of that isolation. You're not in a church full of people that are wanting to sell you. You're not in a community of faith right now that wants to abuse you. You're not in a society of Jesus followers that want to put you in the bottom of a pit and say, good luck by yourself. If you haven't heard anyone say this to you in your life, if you had a mom that walked out or a dad that abused or a child or a babysitter that betrayed the trust of the family that's happened to you, I want to let you know that there is a God in heaven, that was never the plan. The plan is to save you. The plan is to free you, but it was never for everybody to abuse you. So today I want to say this, take courage. Take courage and move forward with your dream. And I think I made a mistake in interpreting the Bible. It's just my opinion. Let me tell you why. Because as I was kind of reviewing this all this week, I was thinking, what was Joseph feeling like in this pit? And somewhere along the line, here's what I said. God, why would you let this happen to me? God, you're no good. God, you're not fair. Wouldn't you think that'd be justified to say if you were Joseph? So I started putting all these words into Joseph's mouth that Joseph never said himself. Actually, when you fast forward and Joseph gets in Potiphar's house falsely accused, he never says something to God there. Actually, when he's in the prison and the cupbearer was supposed to give good news to him, by the way, we're going to cover all this in the weeks to come, he never said something about God there. When his brothers showed up and Joseph had the power to kill them without question, Joseph said nothing there. When his father died, and the brothers come and say, now that dad's dead, we're sure you're going to kill us. Here's what Joseph said for them. What you intended to harm me, God intended for good, to free, to deliver, to set free all of you at this time. I've been a part of a greater plan in God's life, and it's to free people. At what point of Joseph's journey, at what point of journey do we come to the fact that God didn't want that to happen, but God will use that to happen to get us from what we've always known and believed to where he needs us to be? And it isn't that you can't ask God questions. I'll say it this blunt. If you ever hear someone say, just never question God, I question them. Why? I've read all of David's writings. He questioned God nonstop. How could you let my enemies do this? How are all those unrighteous still prospering? How is it? But then at the end of it, there's always a but God. Don't forget your but. The moment, I didn't mean it to sound like that, but there it is. There's a sermon series coming. Don't forget your but. But don't forget your but. Why? Because if you forget your but, you forget to tell God, he's still worthy. You're still in control. Even though all of my brothers, even though all of your family, even though all of your coworkers, even though everyone you think you know loves you, even though they're beating down on you and they want to destroy you and they want to strip the beauty that you think is beautiful away from you, God is there to see you get into the destiny that he's called you to. But along those lines, by the way, this is just the truest statement I can think of to say. I love you enough to be honest with you. The catalyst for change that God uses is rarely the method that we would pick. If I say this, God would like you to alter your thinking in blank. And you have two options. A, be sold into slavery. Or B, an angel show up with a golden scroll to tell you about it. Which one picks B every single time? Like, I'm really going to believe you, God. It's Gabriel. Like he's the big dog. He comes down and he's like, what's up? I mean, it's 2018. That's what he would do. Like, can you read this? Oh, it's Hebrew? No, I translated it. So that was a really dumb joke too. So Like, I would believe that. I would follow that. I would go with that. But most likely, you know what God uses? The person next to you. The relationship conflict. The disappointment we had in our head. Because if we don't go through a process of change, we will actually always collapse under the promise of change. Because what I live in here, in the land of familiar, I have a whole mindset that believes what I believe. And usually what happens when change occurs, when we try to go to make a move, we always default back to old thinking. Right? So if you're gonna decide to lose weight and you're gonna do good and you're gonna focus in and you're gonna make it a lifestyle change and all that, and all of a sudden you have a bad day at work, those Oreos looked real good. We default back, right? We're going to get debt-free, and we're going to stop spending money, and we're going to do all these things, and all of it's going really good until you see something shiny, you're right back into debt. But if you go through a process to allow God to change your mindset, in that process of mindset change, we have a belief change, our action change, and once our action change and our belief change, guess what? A promise can rest on something new. So we have to go through a process in order to get us where we need to, but God will let you believe what you are, what you do believe, in order to get you there eventually. But the question is, as you move there, if you're in a pit, if you're in a prison, if you're in a palace, or in your, are you allowing God to do what he needs to in your life at that moment to make you who he has for you to be in the future? And so I think I put on Joseph all the thoughts I would have had. And I think that's unfair to do to Joseph. But I do think it points out to me what I really believe in God. Do I judge him fairly? And by the way, these are my questions. They don't have to be your questions. But when a situation happens, do I actually give God the credit or the blame? When a tough situation arises, do I say, God, where's the good in this so that you can get me through this? When relational conflict happens, do we go to war with each other or do we go to worship with each other? And I know for me, I think I should take more from what Joseph has to offer than what I had to offer. Because you didn't hear him complain here. But when he gets to the next place, he's everything that God's called him to be. He was the hardest worker to the point where he became the head of everything. We're going to talk about all that next week. But I want to say this to you this week. Don't fail in the process of going to your dream. You're in a process. And when, well, God didn't make this happen. He allowed this to happen because unfortunately we have to do life with other people and people have free will and they make choices. And personally, and I mean this, if everyone would make the choices I do, the world would be perfect. And if you think about that, you would say the same thing. That's true. Because you think you're perfect because if you weren't perfect, you would change what you do. So like my marriage would be fantastic if my wife would just act exactly the way that I think she should act. But it's no longer a marriage. It's a cloning at that point. Right? So it takes relationships to occur, but in those relationships, God in his sovereign hand grows us in who we need to be. So where in your life right now are you stuck in the land of familiar, knowing there's a place in your life that needs to change, but you haven't allowed the process of change to occur to get you where God's going to? Some people, this is going to be a very easy answer, quick to come up with. Others of you, you're going to discover it over the next 7-8 weeks as we just continue to have this conversation. But I believe this to the bottom of my heart. I believe everybody in here has some type of a dream that God has given you that you should be pursuing right now. But what is the fear that keeps you from moving forward? Because courage is nothing more than taking an action step in the midst of fear. So I'm just going to say this prayer over you now. I have one question for everybody. God, I pray today, just as we pause here at the end, where's the place in our life that we need courage? What is the place in our life that we know that we should be making change in, but we refuse to because of fear? God, give us the ability to take that step today. Give us the ability to move past that. I pray for right now anybody who's in a family situation where kids and exes are at war and not at peace. God, I pray that today's lesson gives a little insight to how to bring peace about and the necessity for peace. I'm not saying everyone around the same Thanksgiving table, but truly, God, the ability for everyone to look out for that next generation in the way that they should go. I pray for any of us that have those friends that would seem to abuse us, look out for themselves more than our well-being, that always seem to take and never give. Lord, I pray for wisdom in those situations, how to navigate those waters. I pray today for anyone who's sitting in here and you feel alone and you feel isolated and you feel abandoned. I pray today that the arms of a loving God embraces you in a way that you've never felt before. You know, I just want to pause there. If you keep your eyes closed and your head bowed, there's some of you that have never had the experience of God embracing you. You've never had the experience of a Savior saying yes to you. What you had is you've had a life where you have fought and you have worn and you have gone and you have done, but you aren't as satisfied with your life. You're not satisfied where you are. You're not content with what you've been experienced. And as I've been talking today about God or Joseph, there's something inside of you coming alive. And that aliveness that I am referring to is because of a man named Jesus. Where Abraham did not sacrifice his son, God did sacrifice his son. And he sacrificed his son on your behalf so that you would know a living God that wants to have a personal relationship with you. Maybe you've been coming to church for a while. Maybe you would know some people, maybe you've backslidden. Maybe you've walked away from. Today's the day that I want to invite you to step up to and stay with God. Just right now, with eyes closed and heads bowed all around the room, if you're here today and you would like to accept Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior and begin a journey with Him, could I invite you just to simply raise your hand just so I can see that you've made that decision? As eyes are closed, heads are bowed, if you're watching us online right now, the same question goes out for you. There's hands coming up around this room right now, and I believe right there in your living room, as you're driving in your car, listening to this podcast, streaming it, wherever you might be, I believe the same decision can be made for you right now. And we look forward to hearing from you to celebrate that step with you. But I'm going to invite you online to say the same prayer that we're going to say here. Could everyone repeat after me? Dear Jesus, today, I believe that I need you. So I choose to want you. Forgive me of my sins. Become Lord of my life. And today, I follow you. God, I thank you for every decision that's made. And it says so clear in your word that all of heaven rejoices when anyone makes a decision for you. And so, God, today we choose to rejoice. In the name of Jesus. Can we put our hands together and just celebrate with everyone who... Incredible.